If you ache for truth, goodness, and beauty, if you're hungry for a Christianity with substance and strength, if you long for a faith that's big and bold and biblical and all about Jesus Christ, if you're inspired by the idea of one church that has spanned 20 centuries, 24 time zones, and two hemispheres, enfolding every race, nation, and language, then you're considering Catholicism. Welcome back to the Considering Catholicism podcast. My name is Greg, your host, and I am here again with Corey.
Good afternoon, or whatever it is, where you are.
I thought maybe we could go back to the secret compound, but a thunderstorm seems to have blown in, and so we are one more time indoors. Hopefully, we'll be outdoors again at the secret compound soon, but kind of excited today to tackle a question that's a fun and unusual question. Why does the Pope have his own country? I mean, I love the question. I love this whole thing, right? As some of you are aware, the Vatican is actually a sovereign nation state.
Yeah, it's a city state.
It's a nation state that's the size of a city, or it's actually even smaller than a city. It's 108 acres, which is about the size of a medium-sized golf course. But it is its own nation state, sovereign nation state. It's got embassies all around the world. It's recognized as a country. It has observer status in the United Nations, all this kind of stuff. Up until recently, it issued its own currency, has its own army. We'll get into all of this, but it's sort of a unique thing because there's really no other religious leader in the world that has his own country dedicated specifically. Like, there have been religious leaders who, even in modern times, who were sort of the head of state. So, for example, up until the 1950s or something, in Tibet, the country of Tibet, the Dalai Lama functioned as the head of state. Of course, the King of England is also the head of church. But what's unique about the Vatican is it is a nation state specifically defined by the papacy. That's its reason for existing. It isn't like there's this country that has its own reason for existing, and then the Pope just happens to be the head of it. It's the Pope gets his own country.
Right. It's theocracy. Yeah.
Yeah. He's the head of state and the supreme temporal civil leader of his own state. So anyway, it's kind of different and it's kind of cool, but it raises this interesting and weird question, which is, why does the Pope have his own country? I'm going to start off with a little bit of economic history.
Sure.
Because I don't think that we can answer this question until we understand something about economics in the world up until about 100 or 200 years ago. Throughout most of world history, the issue is, how do you preserve capital or wealth? Okay. So, for example, if right now what we do is you put your money in the stock market. I mean, you have a portfolio of a market account, blah, 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 stocks, bonds, whatever. And then that generates income, right? That's how we do with your retirement account. That's what your local school board or college does. It has a stocks and bonds portfolio, and that's what generates its income, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
But throughout most of world history, you didn't have markets like that that would be a way that you would not only preserve wealth or capital, but generate income based on that. Throughout most of world history, the way that you preserved wealth and capital and generated income off it was by owning land. Land, obviously, is a tangible asset, but it also generates income.
You farm it or you raise livestock on it.
Yeah. I mean, depending on what the land has to offer, as you say, farming, timber, livestock, timber, fish, if it's on a coast, if it has metals like ores and mining or whatever, but the land produces income in tangible goods. So throughout most of history, if you want to preserve wealth, you acquire land And then that land generates those products, that wealth. Mm-hmm. Or another way you do that is through rents, right? So you own land and you can either farm it yourself or have your people farm it. Or what you do is you have tenant farmers. And the tenant farmers grow the crops, raise the cattle, and pay you rent.
Yep, give you a portion usually of the harvest.
So what that does, obviously, is it generates an ongoing income. And so again, throughout almost all of world history, this is how wealth or capital is protected and preserved, and it generates wealth, just like we have stock market returns, mm-hmm. right? And everybody did that. Governments did that. Organizations did that. If you go back to the Middle Ages or you go back to the Roman times, you would have a duke or a count or whatever, and they would have lands, and the lands created rents, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
And that was what preserved them. And so if you look at, say, like the kings, king of France or whatever, there were lands that were attached to the crown or lands that were attached to certain noble houses. And
yep.
All making
yep.
sense? Because you have expenses. You have to maintain the buildings. You have to pay people. You have to feed people. You have to do all the things you've got to do. And that's where it comes from. All right. Here's my economics lesson.
Yes.
So now let's apply this to the church. Mm-hmm. Because if we go back to Roman times, the question was, how do I support the diocese or support the church or support or help build the cathedral or maintain the cathedral?
Yeah, or care for the poor, or any number of things that the church is doing. I think this is actually a little bit before where we want to start, but it brings me back to in the book of Acts, where you have people donating land or selling their yeah. land and putting the money at the feet of the apostles in order to provide for the needs of the church. You have that from day one.
Yeah, excellent point. I mean, that was in the ancient world what you would do. People coming in the book of Acts to the apostles and saying, here's this farm and I'll give the farm. They could either sell the farm or they could just maintain the farm and then the rents would come in and mm-hmm. the crops would come in, the rents would come in, and then that income could be used. So at a very early time, the same rules that applied to everybody else applied to the church, which is that the church began to acquire lands. How did it acquire lands? They were donated, like you say, yep. when people gave them to the apostles. So wealthy Romans, for example, who converted to Christianity, and maybe these wealthy Romans had villas or farmlands, if they were a noble person, mm-hmm. they would say, hey, I'll give 1,000 acres, or I'll give this farm, or I'll give this to the church to generate income to, as you say, do all things it has to do. Feed the poor, feed the priests, mm-hmm. build the buildings, just all the operational costs of the ministry.
Yeah, and that's mostly in the period starting with the Emperor Constantine, who legalizes the church, and afterwards, because before that, with the persecutions and the instability, there wasn't a lot of ability for the church to hold on to wealth, to have that stably. But starting with Constantine, you have the emperor himself donating lands to the church, very famous church buildings like the Lateran Basilica, where the Pope has his cathedra, it's his cathedral, was donated by Constantine. And then, as you say, families, especially noble families, donating things to the church and then specifically to the Pope in Rome.
And whether that is, as you say, to the church or to the monasteries.
Sure, yeah.
So if you have monks and you want the monks to pray for you and do their masses and do other monkish activities, right?
Yep.
You've got to build the monastery. You have to fix the roof. You have to feed the monks. They work and this and that. But the income that keeps the monastery going and gives the monastery excess income to give to the poor, what you would have is people say, to support this monastery, this group of monks, I will donate this farm and another farm. And so over time, the monastery acquires these lands. Mm-hmm. And either the monks are going to work them themselves, or what more typically happened is somebody says, here's 1,000 acres, and it has tenant farmers on it. And so the tenant farmers used to be paying me, but now they're just going to send their rent check to rent check or whatever, right? Yeah,
barrels of
they're going to mail the rent check, so to speak, to the monastery. And then the monastery has that income to sustain itself. Mm-hmm. Okay, we're working our way. Someone said, "Well, what does this have to do with the Pope having his own country?" We're working up to that, right? So over time, what happens is the papacy, the Pope in Rome, the Bishop mm-hmm. of Rome, begins to acquire lands around Rome, farmlands in particular, that would be valuable because they're income producing. And as you say, some of those things were donated by Constantine, particularly certain buildings, as you say, the Lateran Palace, and there's some other church buildings that were actually Roman basilicas. They were, or Roman civil buildings,
right?
But they're given to the papacy so that they can be converted to churches and used for other purposes. But what happens through the end of the Roman imperial period and the early Middle Ages is the number of farms around Rome that belong to the papacy and are generating income for the papacy to support its works grows. Now, if anyone's ever been to Rome, you drive a short distance outside the city, and like a lot of cities, it just turns to farmland. And Rome's a big, dense city, but you drive out of it, and then it's just farmland for 20, 30, 40 miles. And it was that in the past. And so over time, those farms become under the control, ownership of the papacy. And that radius, let's say, from Rome of those lands that are owned by the papacy gets bigger and bigger and bigger.
Yeah. And at the same time, you have sort of the deterioration of civil authority in the area. Constantine moved the seat of the empire to the east, to what became Constantinople. The empire was still in authority over Rome and the Italian peninsula, but as the centuries went by and the empire itself started to fall apart, there wasn't nearly as much authority and protection being exercised by the empire and its legions in the area. And so the Pope has these lands now that he has acquired through donations, and there's a vacuum of civil authority. And so the natural thing that happens is that the Pope starts to exercise a lot of the functions that the civil authority used to, just to hold things together, because it's a period of instability. There's invading armies coming from the north in and out all the time. There isn't that central government there anymore. So somebody's got to pick up the slack, and he already has, by virtue of having these lands, a lot of authority and secular power.
Yeah. I mean, if you think about all the things that that entails, so if you own 50, 100 miles of land in radius going out from the city of Rome, you've got to fix the roads.
Mm-hmm. Build the bridges.
Build the bridges when the rivers get washed them out. You've got to, there's going to be crimes. Some guy's going to steal the other guy's chicken. Somebody's going to murder his neighbor. And so you have to have police functions, and you have to have courts, and you have to all these things. So the Pope begins to have really kind of two parts to his job. He is obviously the Bishop of Rome, and he's the leader of the worldwide Catholic Church, but he also becomes the civil or temp governor over these lands and has to manage all of the government functions that you would. Police, fire. You have to have fire brigades. You have to have...
And of course, he's going to end up developing the bureaucracy that any kind of government tends to have, because one man at the top can't do everything.
And as you alluded to, the situation in Italy gets really dicey after the fall of the Western Roman Empire. Mm-hmm. And one, this might be a good point to point out, that Italy is a little bit of a misnomer. Well, it's not a misnomer now, but historically it is, because Italy traditionally for thousands of years is a place, not a country.
It's a peninsula. It's a geographic region, but it until the modern period, until the 19th century, it never was a nation state.
Yeah.
I mean, that's true of many nation states in Europe.
But we'll get to this in a minute, but Italy doesn't become a country. There is no such country as Italy until 1870. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's after our Civil War.
Right. Yeah. Italy is younger as a nation than the United States.
Oh, yeah. What it was is a region like Central America, which has, what, five countries in it, six maybe. And then you have South America or something, or Western Europe.
Yeah.
Or
smaller than those, obviously. But in the way that it's a general region that has not been politically united or had its own, a single identity or even a single language.
No. And there were all these different nation states on it. You had the Kingdom of Naples, mm-hmm. which is just south of Rome. And the Kingdom of Naples also came under the control of various, we might call them foreign powers, France or Austria or
Spain,
yeah. or at a certain point, the Norman Knights, right? And then you have the Lombard region, which is sort of the northwest part of Italy. And then you have Campania, which is down in the south. And then you have the island of Sicily, and you have all these different parts of Italy.
And a lot of independent city-states.
Yep. Yeah. Florence is an independent city-state, all these different things. And so they're all sovereign states, and they're all governed by different governments, and they are often at war with each other.
Oh yeah, all the time.
And you have all these foreign powers because it's a real strategic place. Mm-hmm. And so, as we said, you have France and Austria and Spain and all of these other powers that are always backing the little kingdoms and city-states of Italy in little wars with each other, mm-hmm. vying for control. And so one of the problems in all of that is that the papacy runs the risk of being basically steamrollered and taken over.
Becoming the toady of whichever power happens to be in ascendancy on the peninsula at any given time.
Exactly. Where you could have one of these foreign powers takes over, particularly the area around Rome, and now says the Pope works for us now.
Yeah.
He's one of our citizen or whatever, but we've got control of it. And so there was always this desire to keep the papacy independent. And I think this is one of the misunderstandings. You'll have a lot of non-Catholics, a lot of critical Protestants will say, oh, the Pope was always wrapped up in all of these European politics, or he's under the control of all these European powers, or he controls the European powers. But the real truth of it is throughout most of its history, all of its history, the story of the papacy is the story of it struggling to maintain its independence.
And the half-truth behind that myth is, of course, that it always was a struggle, that there always were powers that were trying to dominate the papacy. They would dominate it for a time, and then it would regain its independence. I mean, there's a whole long history of that that we can't possibly get into all the details. But the point is that the whole time, the papacy, and the whole point of the papacy having its own state, was to fight back against that tendency as much as possible.
Yeah. So this becomes recognized by a guy named Pepin the Short.
I wonder how he felt about that.
I know. That's not like how I'd want to go down history, but Pepin the Short was the leader of the Franks. Okay. He's the father of Charlemagne. Yeah. There was Pepin the Short and then Charlemagne. So in 756, Pepin comes down to Italy mm-hmm. with his armies. And he basically intervenes in these wars on the peninsula between the Lombards from the northwest part of the peninsula with, I don't know, they're fighting within the kingdom of Naples and so on, right? All these endless wars.
It's complicated.
And he comes down there, and the Lombards had encroached into all around Rome, encroached on the areas of papal control. And so Pepin the Short comes down. He's a faithful Catholic, and he kicks the Lombards out of that area of central Italy around Rome. And then what he does is he donates those lands. So it's an area, maybe a 100-mile radius around Rome. So if you look at the Italian peninsula, Rome's on the western coast of the peninsula, the western side of it, and it's about halfway down the boot. And there's this kind of zone that goes out about 100 miles. It's called the Donation of Pepin, 756 AD. He gives that to the papacy, like signs this treaty and all that, and says, this is now your sovereign state. These lands belong to the papacy to provide basically two functions. One is to be a protective buffer zone so that all these other countries and states and city-states and whatever warring powers aren't going to encroach on the papacy and try to seize the Pope. Mm-hmm. And then secondly, that 100-mile zone is basically income-producing lands that supports the church.
Yeah.
Right? Now, this might be a good time to just bring up this other thing that comes up in papal history, which is the donation of Constantine.
Mm.
Okay? So there is this document floating around in the Middle Ages called the Donation of Constantine that purports to say that the Emperor Constantine gave the papacy temporal or civil, basically earthly political power. And The document says, I, Constantine the Emperor, before I skedaddle over and form Constantinople in the East, I sort of give control not only of the area around the Papal States, but I give sort of supreme control of the Western Roman Empire to the Pope.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And this spurious document gets waved around a lot in the Middle Ages to say, hey, this is why the Pope has power or whatever.
Or why he should have more.
Or why he should have more, or why the King of France or somebody should listen to him. But that document was proven to be false actually in the Renaissance.
Yep. Yep.
There were Renaissance scholars who began to look at it and go, this thing doesn't
add up. Yeah.
Doesn't add up. This is sort of a rabbit trail, not worth going down. But what they did is they looked at the Latin, mm-hmm. the language in it, and they showed through philological analysis that it was using Latin words and phrases and grammar that weren't in use at the time of Constantine. So it's basically a medieval forgery.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't want to waste any more time on the donation of Constantine other than to say that the donation of Pepin is real in 756. That was legitimate. Right. We do have historical documents. And he gave that buffer zone around Rome to the papacy.
And to some extent, for the basic premise here, it wouldn't even matter whether there had been a donation of Pepin. It's simply the case that for practical reasons that we've discussed, the Pope needed to have some territory, but it is the historical reality that that's how the Papal States really got codified and solidified into a unit, was during that period when Pepin and the Franks kind of gave the Pope a hand.
Up until then, it's just like, I have a deed to this farm and I have a deed to another farm, and it's kind of a patchwork thing. But this actually creates a state or a thing called the Papal States.
Right. I guess what I mean is that it's not as if the Pope needed a secular ruler in order to say, hey, it's okay for you to do this.
No,
but in practical reality,
you had the armies of the Franks and everything else. They established it and they carved it out and it became legitimate.
Right.
And I don't know, wow, this, I don't even know if I want to make this analogy because of all the things that are in the news right now, but it's sort of like after World War II in 1947, the United Nations creates the State of Israel and says, this is a legitimate sovereign state.
I mean, there's been hundreds of treaties like that throughout history of rewriting boundaries or solidifying
But that's what the donation of Pepin in 756 does, is it creates this legitimate sovereign area called the Papal States. And that lasts a really long time. So this area of central Italy, its boundaries get encroached on and they grow and they shrink a little bit over
time. There are some popes that end up getting ambitious and try to expand it. And there are periods in which other powers chip away at it.
They never tried to like have this imperial design. We're going to conquer the whole boot of Italy. But yeah, the boundaries and which cities and where the boundaries fall and all these things. For example, you had Pope Julius II who comes in right around the end of the 1400s, beginning of the 1500s. And he's an interesting character because his desire is to restore the power of the Papal States, which had gotten so encroached on. In fact, we didn't bring this up right prior to that. The Papal States had so shrunk down in the 1300s and 1400s to the point where they were not sustainable. The Pope didn't have that safety buffer zone from being invaded, and the incomes had been depleted. And so the papacy moved to France for 70 years, the Avignon papacies, where the popes for 70 years were living in southern France in this city called Avignon, basically as guests of the French, under the control of the French.
Guests is a nice way to put it.
Yeah. And it was St. Catherine of Siena who went over and told the Pope, you need to go back to Rome because you're the Bishop of Rome. And he comes back and Rome's fallen down. The Papal States are shrunken and decrepit and they're not safe because there's warring armies moving through central Italy and there's no money because the rents hadn't been collected and all that. And so Pope Julius II basically forms an army or hires, you know, mercenaries or whatever and starts reconquering. He was called the warrior Pope. He had a suit of armor and would kind of ride around. And Protestants love to point this out because it was right before the Protestant Reformation.
Right, right.
And it's like, why the Pope rides around in armor with an army and all this kind of stuff. But again, in context, what he was doing was trying to reclaim that buffer zone area and those Papal States and restore the power of the Papal States.
And that's not to apologize for everything that every pope did as secular ruler of the Papal States. I mean, mistakes were made. History is messy, but...
Yeah, I mean, it's a complicated thing that the Pope has these sort of two roles. Mm-hmm. And in his role as the civil leader of the Papal States, there were all kinds of things that he had to do, right? I mean, again, you have to fix the roads and the bridges, and you have to have police functions, and you have to protect your boundaries or your, what do you, your
you borders. Have to punish criminals. Yeah.
I could protect your borders.
Yeah.
So what happens when competing armies rampage through the farms and the villages of your papal states, and you have to protect them? So that was why he had mercenary armies, which is, by the way, as we'll get to this in a little bit, where the Swiss Guard today came from.
Sure.
The Swiss Guard were Swiss mercenaries that the papacy hired because they were really good soldiers to come down and basically patrol and protect the papal states. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So from 756 onward, and it kind of shrinks and grows, the papal states are there. Now, let's fast forward to around 1800, right? So that's 1,000 years. Napoleon Bonaparte, when he's conquering Europe, he comes rampaging through Italy, and he actually kidnaps the Pope for a
while. Kidnaps two different popes,
two different popes, and he takes control of the papal states and all this kind of stuff. It's a real mess. When Napoleon gets exiled and all that kind of stuff and comes to an end, there's a treaty called the Council of Vienna in 1815 that restores the Papal States as a state once again. And that lasts until 1870. So what happened is roughly during the time of our United States Civil War, 1860 to 1865, there's a massive civil war raging in Italy.
Yeah.
It's led by a guy named Garibaldi, another guy named Cavour, and they're revolutionaries. They're kind of communist revolutionaries. They're part of
part of the wider revolutionary movements of that era.
Yeah. But Garibaldi's inspired by the early Marxism of that era and everything else. Well,
they're also nationalists.
And they're nationalists.
Yeah. Because they're trying to pull together a nation state out of Italy that had never been a nation state before, that the peoples of the different parts of the peninsula had never all spoken even the same language. They had to invent basically promote one dialect of the languages spoken in order to make
period,
Italian.
I think it's called the Rigiorimento, which is like they were restoring the Roman glory of Italy, and they were going to create something called the Kingdom of Italy. And by the way, just an aside on the language thing, one of the things that's super fun and interesting to me is that the modern Italian is based on the dialect of Florence.
Because
of Dante and Dante's Divine Comedy, which is written in the dialect or the sort of sublanguage spoken in Florence. And it becomes so popular all around because everyone wants
to... Yeah, it's considered basically the great founding work of Italian literature.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so as you say, you have all these different languages, all these different cultures on the peninsula, and they get united by Garibaldi and Cavour, who finally conquer the whole peninsula, including conquering the Papal States and Rome. Mm-hmm. And in 1870, they create this thing called the Kingdom of Italy, which creates a problem for the Pope because he's sitting in the Vatican.
Right.
And now he is in the Kingdom of Italy, and he's lost two important things. Number one, obviously, he's lost the revenues that come from the Papal States. So now the papacy is broke. Church is broke. The other thing is he's lost his buffer zone. If he steps outside the building, if he walks out of the Vatican, he's now in the Kingdom of Italy, and he's subject to the laws and control, and he could be arrested by the Kingdom of Italy. So the Pope at that time declares himself a prisoner in the Vatican.
And from Pius the Ninth until... golly, the 20s, I believe. No pope after being elected left the Vatican.
No, they all declared themselves to be a prisoner in the Vatican. That was their term. And they said, I can't leave this building because if I leave this building, I'm subject to the civil control and arrest and whatnot of the Kingdom of Italy. And this thing becomes known in Italian politics as the Roman question. Mm-hmm. So you have this institution that's almost 2,000 years old, so much a part of Italian history and Italian culture and Italian civilization, and you've got this basically standoff, right, between the Kingdom of Italy, the government there, and the Pope sitting in the Vatican as a prisoner.
And it's not in any way sort of theoretical that he might face issues if he comes out of there either, because that unification movement in Italy was strongly anti-clerical. They were closing down monasteries and persecuting priests.
Which is why I said earlier that Garibaldi in particular was influenced by early Marxism, in that he's kind of atheistic, anti-clerical, anti-religious. They want to shut the church down. So there's this standoff where many or most Italian people are supportive of the Pope, but then there's now this new country. And the Roman question is, what are we going to do with Rome and the Pope? Mm-hmm. And what are we going to do with the formal papal state? So this lasts 60 years from 1870 up until 1929. Now, in 1922, Benito Mussolini becomes the leader of the Kingdom of Italy and his fascists. And Mussolini is a complicated guy. He's a fascist, but part of their fascism is restoring the glory of Italy. And he hearkens back to the glories of Rome, and he wants to sort of unite Italy in this kind of Italian civilization, and there's a lot of patriotism. I have no idea, you know, Mussolini is a faithful Catholic or not.
My impression is that he was a pragmatist in this regard.
Right. But he recognized that he could never really unify Italy and create this kind of Italian patriotism until you solved the Roman question. And so he opens negotiations with the papacy in the 1920s, and they negotiate something called the Lateran Treaty, which gets signed in 1929. And the Lateran Treaty does three things. First of all, it says the papal states as you knew them were no more, but they're going to be shrunk to essentially just the Vatican.
Right, the Vatican city-state, yeah.
So the Vatican city-state is created as all that is left of the papal states, which is 108 acres, the area just literally around St. Peter's Square and the buildings, you know, there. But that's the first provision. Secondly, the papacy will be compensated financially for the loss of the papal states, because again, the Pope's income was gone, and those lands had belonged to the papacy for what, at that point?
Many of them 1,000 years.
Yeah. 1,200 years. And so what Mussolini did in the Lateran Treaty is, number one, they gave a lump sum payment, some big amount, to the Vatican, and then they set up a annuity so the Vatican would get so much money every year for the loss of its lands. And then the third thing that Lateran Treaty did was it established the role of the church in Italian society. And this is, like you say, part of Mussolini's pragmatism, but also recognizing the role of the Catholic Church in Italy. So it makes the Catholic Church the sort of official religion of Italy. Mm-hmm. It puts crucifixes in classrooms,
religious
and
education in classrooms,
religious education for the kids, and it reestablishes in the Kingdom of Italy the role of the Catholic Church. But it does reduce the Pope to that 108 acres, but it then compensates the Pope financially for the loss of that income. And a lot of what we might think of now as the Vatican's sort of investment holdings come back to that compensation that was given to them in 1929, mm-hmm. right? And that brings us up to the modern era of the papacy. And it's a good time to stop this conversation. And then we're going to start another conversation when we talk about the Vatican from 1929 to today and how the Vatican is its own country today. But that's how it was, how the papal states were, and how they came to be.
Awesome.
Okay. Thanks, Corey.
Yep, thanks.